But first up, the dark side of family. Marrying a doctor in your hometown in the 1970s, one who takes a principled stand against the Vietnam War, sounds like a good move, doesn't it? Helen Cummings thought so, especially when, as a medical student, Stuart Winter had helped Helen's mother, Joy Cummings, in her campaign to become Newcastle's first female alderman. In fact, Joy Cummings went on to become Newcastle's first female Lord Mayor. Not too long afterwards, as Dr. Stuart Winter, he made a medical diagnosis for Helen's father, which transformed her father's life. So no wonder Helen married the man. There wasn't a happy ending, though. Helen Cummings has written an account of her marriage and what followed called Blood Vows, a haunting memoir of marriage and murder. Helen, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Jane.
And welcome also to Richard Spencer, the CEO of the Benevolent Society, a welfare agency which is campaigning for changes to the current Family Law Act. Hi, Richard.
Morning, Jane.
Now, Helen, I'll start with you. You married young and you were very impressed by this man. And after the introduction, I can see why, weren't you? You were very impressed.
I certainly was. He was tall, he was handsome, he was intelligent, he had lovely green eyes and he wore nice clothes and he was worldly.
Yeah. But then after you married, what were the sort of things that started to happen?
Oh, look, not long after we were married, for no apparent reason, he started throwing alarm clocks that went off in the morning. He'd lose his temper over nothing. I blamed myself, but little things would trigger him, his anger, and that just descended as the marriage progressed. It got worse. But look, in the beginning, yeah, I just blamed myself and tried to change whatever it was, or, you know,
that was annoying him.
Yes, what I thought was annoying him anyway.
So were you thinking that this behaviour was in some way normal? I mean, you say you blamed yourself, that it was your fault, but did you see it as normal or acceptable, or were you starting to worry?
Well, look, I'd never experienced anything like that in my family life, and I just looked up to him so much. He was intelligent, he was a doctor, and, you know, he was treating patients, and so it had to be something that was going on at home. It had to be his life with me. But, you know, he kept shifting the bar and till it was unreachable. Mm. But, yeah, I just thought that it was my fault.
Even when he smashed up the house with that walking stick or something?
Well, I blame stress for that. I thought he was working 110 hours. He was rostered on 110 hours as a young doctor at the hospital and he was doing post-mortems. I just thought, gosh, you know, something's going terribly wrong in his mind to upset him to that degree. I was a little bit frightened, but not enough to leave him because I still forgave him and he did apologise.
Yeah,
I forgave him.
Did your family know about the trouble you were in at that early stage?
They did, but it was still my marriage. You know, I just think they looked on and with great concern, but in the end he was my husband and, you know, because he was doing amazing things as well, like I talk about in the trying to stop the war in a small way, and they knew, and like towards the end, they weren't surprised when I packed up and came home.
And speaking of that, there was a turning point out in the middle of the Pacific on a Micronesian island for you, wasn't there?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, he was offered a contract there, and he would only
take... It was Barnaba, the island.
Barnaba. You're part of the Kiribati nation, yeah. Yes. He was offered a contract, but he would only sign it if I promised to take the children over there. And I thought, oh, this will be lovely because there's going to be a lot of time that he'll be away from us in Newcastle. And it didn't seem like a big ask to take them over there. So I went twice, and the first time wasn't too bad. Nothing terrible happened. But the second time, oh gosh, I knew I was in trouble. And looking back now with the laws, he wouldn't have been charged with murder. And I had to escape from him one night. He chased me with a fishing knife, and we'd been to a New Year's Eve party, and I managed to get out of the house, but Sarah and Brendan were still there, and I had to hide under a house next door. And it was probably one of the worst days of my life. I was so frightened because I thought I was going to lose them, and I could see him walking into the bedroom a couple of times, and I just had to put my head between my legs to stop myself screaming and wait till the family whose house I was under came home. And then I had the difficult thing to do to convince them that I wasn't the mad wife of the lovely doctor who had just, you know, gone a bit berserk, and here I was under their house. I had to tell them about my life, what it was like, what Stuart was doing, and how afraid I was for my children. And they rang the manager of the island, and he came around, and they got Sarah and Brendan out of the house and with me, and I just didn't let them go until the next ship arrived and took us off the island.
Yeah. And then back in Australia, you left for good then, didn't you? How did you do that?
There was no way that I was going to risk anything. I applied to the courts for custody. It wasn't followed through. Today it would have to be. In those days, the applications just fell into a black hole. But he was more interested in you know, doing other things and finding another life and... So we just tried to make it the best life we could at home.
So you had full custody of the children?
I think I did.
What?
Pretty sure I did, yeah. In a practical sense, yes. He never tried to take them off me.
Yeah. But he continued to have contact with them, didn't he?
Yes, he did, yes.
And a psychiatrist who helped you and the children wrote a report about Sarah. You quoted in the book, and I'd like to read just a little bit of what it says. The doctor wrote, Sarah is an intelligent, highly sensitive child who has been through a series of situations with her father where she has been overwhelmed by realistic fear of violence and its consequences. She has lost trust that adults will protect her from the protracted fear she experiences when with her father. This is having serious effects on her personality development, causing not only the distrust and insecurity, but preoccupation to the exclusion of schoolwork and relationships with other children. At school, her fear of her father coming to get her overtook her to the degree that she hid in the school's toilet one day and didn't go into the classroom. She told me she had heard her father threaten to kill her mother if she went to court. That's pretty hard.
Mm, that was a child psychiatrist.
Yeah.
That wrote that. Mm.
And so, pardon me, that was very hard to hear then, and I dare say still fairly hard to hear now.
It is, and you know, my children are now grown up, they're adults, but I talk about that legacy in the book that will be ongoing for them because, you know, I, once I divorced, I could move away from him emotionally and that, but for all intents and purposes, he was their dad and he was going to be forever, and fathers are supposed to protect and love their children.
Yeah. You're listening to the story of Helen Cummings, author of Blood Vows, published by 5 Mile Press, talking about her experiences of escaping domestic violence. That's not the end of the story. The biggest tragedy lay ahead. But before we get to that, I'd like to bring in Richard Spencer. Richard, in that situation now, and Helen's alluded to this, under the Family Law Act that was brought in 2006, would the court be compelled to consider time with both parents, even if one parent wasn't even asking for it?
Yes, they would. And in fact, those changes that came in 2006 have created problems, particularly in this area of family violence and child abuse. And the story that Helen is sharing with us this morning, I've heard from many other mothers as well. And since 2006, there have been 3 major studies to look at this. And all of them have recommended there be significant changes to that law, particularly around this situation of women feeling that they can't even raise these issues within the court, and if they do, they'll be penalised.
That's a real problem, isn't it? Because if you think about Helen's situation, I was very interested and moved, Helen, when you said I had to convince them that I wasn't the mad wife of the upstanding doctor, and that's still part of the problem, isn't it, Richard?
It's a huge problem because there is still that culture of disbelief in society that this can't be happening. And abuse takes many forms. Many people think, well, it's physical abuse, there'll be signs of that. But in fact, you're talking about psychological abuse, financial abuse, even to family, pets and animals. So there are all kinds of ways in which people can be coerced, be living in fear, but it's not obvious to anybody else. And often women are disbelieved in this situation.
And when you say they are even frightened to bring it up, what's caused that?
Well, in the court, and in fact, the perverse situation we have is that some lawyers actually councilwomen not to raise these issues in court because they will be penalised. There is a provision in the 2006 Act which is called the Friendly Parent Provision, and this says to the court that they want to see evidence that parents are being cooperative and working together about the best interests of the child. But if a woman raises allegations, but she can't prove it, and often that's the case, in fact, overwhelmingly that's the case, the court then ends up in a situation of potentially penalising the woman around access and issues around the children's time with both parents. So women are in this position where they feel they can't raise the allegations, and if they can't prove them, there can be cost orders and all kinds of other consequences to that. So as a result, women feel, and the studies have shown this, that there are real barriers to them being able to tell the story in the way that Helen is this morning.
The federal government has moved to reform the Family Law Act, and those reforms are now before a Senate committee. What are you saying, Richard, in your submission for the Benevolent Society? Will the proposed reforms do what's needed to solve this awful situation?
Well, we think it's a great start, but we absolutely believe it needs to go further, because in the changes that are being looked at the moment, we will still have this issue of shared parenting arrangements as being one of the primary considerations. We take the view, and this has been reflected in other studies and other submissions, that the safety and the security of the child is paramount. That must be the primary consideration for the court. And for those situations where there is no violence or there's no abuse, fathers, and predominantly fathers in this situation, have nothing to fear from these changes. But it will, going that extra step, will enable people in Helen's situation, mothers in Helen's situation, to be protected and to give the courts the opportunity to do that in the best possible way.
Helen, you and your children escaped a horrible domestic situation, but Stuart's second family didn't. It's a distressing account in your book about the several days of comings and goings from a flat in a Victorian country town where this young woman, his second wife, and her daughter ended up with Stuart. In a nutshell, what happened?
Well, in a nutshell, he murdered them both at close range with a shotgun and then killed himself.
And the little girl was only four.
Vanessa. Yeah. And that's, I've dedicated my book to them because they have no voice. They didn't live to tell their story.
It's Rakan and Vanessa. Vanessa. And she, of course, came from the island.
Yes.
Yeah, so she was very isolated.
I think she may have been, and even if she had close friends, I don't think she would have told them what was happening. She was probably trying to protect her husband's reputation. But I suspect something fairly terrifying happened to her when she was trying to escape, just from all the accounts that I've read, from the coroner's reports and that, and the cuts on her. I think that she probably escaped from Stuart when he tried to kill her, but then she drove away and came back. She had nowhere to go,
Jane.
She had
nowhere to go. And you say in the book, interestingly enough, that someone reported that she said, "I'm just mad."
Yeah, Dr. Casey can't help me. He can fix people with bad hearts, but he can't fix me because I'm mad. And I just, you know, that's what Stuart used to try and say to me, that, you know, I was going mad, and I knew I would go mad in the end if I stayed with him.
Mm. And you're aware of other people trying to escape violence now because you've been working in the family court.
Yeah, I did. And just to follow on what Richard was saying, the courts base everything on the future, not what happened in the past. And as you know, with Stuart, his worst was yet to come. So and they're not funded to investigate violence, and they haven't really got the jurisdiction. It's a crime. Violence is a crime, and it's a civil court. The family court's a civil court. That's why I'm really disappointed that they're not going to set up a special domestic violence court, that they can investigate and deal and assess each family that comes in, because there will be mothers that still won't raise it. They'll be frightened.
And is that how you'd like to see the law change, or are there other things you'd like to see too?
Well, as Richard said, that hierarchy in the legislation that puts a child's need for a meaningful relationship with both parents before a child's need for nurturing, love and protection against abuse, that can't stay as it is. It's got to be changed.
To both of you now, is there a problem in making law changes to protect children and women? As you pointed out, Richard, it's predominantly women in these violent situations. If those changes then encompass all families, I mean, don't the majority of non-violent parents have the right to time with their children.
No, absolutely. The research shows that that is good for the child, but the changes in 2006 really tilted the balance in the wrong direction, and that's why this bill is seeking to address that situation. As I mentioned before, you know, those people who are not engaged in violence or abuse, who have at their heart the best interests of their children, have nothing to fear for this. This is to address the kind of situation that Helen found herself in, and Leslie Lang from Sydney University recently did a study called No Way to Live of 22 other women who had similar stories to Helen. So this is happening. These changes, and reinforced in the ways that we're talking about, would address that issue and would not compromise in any way the where it does make sense for the child to have shared parenting time.
Can I just say too, Jane, it is only about 7% of cases that get to a hearing. So we are talking about a very small percentage. And that, in that small percentage, the core work in the family court is violence and abuse. So we're dealing with the most conflicted families. And I make this an important statement in my book that most fathers and mothers come to amicable arrangements with their children. They have, you know, and it happened within that relationship and it happens ongoing. It doesn't matter that they've broken up. And they're wonderful parents and they go on to be good mothers and fathers. We're talking about a very small percentage, but they are powerful and they help change the legislation and they wreak the most havoc.
Yeah. Now, Helen, how are your children now? Both adults, of course. Brendan, you say in your book, has a senior role in the public service. And Sarah Winter, of course, is a successful actor, now based in the US. How much do they remember and how do they say it affected them?
Oh, too much. Look, it's another reason I wrote the book. Like, familicide, people don't even know what that word means. It's the killing of one's whole family. And it still came up as a spell check on my computer. Very little research is done, and I can understand that because the families that are left, you can't speak. We couldn't talk about it, and yet I always wanted Sarah and Brendan to be able to. But, of course, Jane, they remembered too much.
Yeah.
Even Brendan, and as a three-year-old, he had to, you know, still go and have contact with his father. It was always with his paternal grandmother, though. She was aware enough to know that there were some problems with her son, that she was with them whenever they went down to Heathcote. But he still took guns out of the boot one day and shot a tree, you know, and Sarah was terrified. She just knew that things could have gone very... And she'd learned to find an escape route, like I had to. So, look, the legacy for them is ongoing.
And for you? Have you found peace now? Has the book helped you to find peace now?
Look, I think it has. Pouring it out into words, it has helped me a lot, and especially because of the work in the family court. Had I not worked in that system for 25 years, I wouldn't have written the book because I wouldn't have known about these things. You know, journalists aren't allowed to write about it. Mothers can't say anything for fear they'll be reprimanded in court if they go and seek help. Yeah, I suppose I do feel a sense of peace, but as I say, you've never forget. It's always there, a little part in your heart that wishes it could have been different and those two people could have lived.
Well, thank you for breaking the culture of silence that you've just described, and thank you for telling us your story, Helen. It's hard to hear, but it's very important, I think, that it is heard, as you say. And thank you also, Richard, for joining us.
Thank you, Jane, for having me on your program.
I've been talking to Helen Cummings, whose book Blood Vows, a haunting memoir of marriage and murder, is published by the 5 Mile Press. Richard Spencer is the CEO of the Benevolent Society, and submissions to the Senate committee hearings close on the 29th of April. You'll find details about everything we've talked about today on our website at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Next on Life Matters, getting on with life in Ipswich post the Queensland floods.